Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
So hello, this is Yana Byers from the New Books Network, and we are here with Elizabeth Otto, the author of Haunted Bauhaus. Hi, Libby, how are you?
Good, thanks. Nice to talk to you.
Oh, it's great to talk to you. So I absolutely loved this book. And I want to say that it's also just beautiful in this way that you don't expect history books to be. You have so many wonderful images. And it's laid out good. I love your font. It's a really beautiful book.
Thanks. The font, I don't know if if I gave you a version that would have had a note at the end of it, but it's actually a Bauhaus font that we chose for the cover and the headers and the page numbers and things. It's designed by one of my favorite two little known Bauhäusler, Xanti Szewinski, and it's been reissued then by Adobe for the centenary. And my designer, the wonderful Jarrett Fuller, found it and said, hey, how about we use this? So I was really, really happy with it.
So why don't you just tell me if you could begin tell me a little bit about yourself. Where are you? Where did you go to school? And why, how you got interested in the Bauhaus?
Sure. Yeah. So I am a professor of art history and visual studies, now situated in a gender studies department at the State University of New York at Buffalo. And I have been working on questions of gender and sexuality really since I was an undergraduate at Oberlin College. I had a wonderful mentor named Pat Matthews, who just passed away a year ago, actually, too young. And she really inspired a bunch of us to engage with questions of gender and sexuality. So I, you know, remember as an undergrad writing, I look back on this when I think about my own students, you know, sometimes they look so young, but they are interested in sometimes very grown-up questions. So I remember myself writing a paper for her on porn and, you know, renting a porn video at a store and like sitting with my friend and watching and taking notes and then reading feminist theory on porn, you know, like with this sort of utmost seriousness about a very racy topic. And I just think I was curious about human sexuality and representation, but then also gender dynamics and power and how all of these things play out and sometimes get worked out in pictures. And then, so I did my master's at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, and my PhD at the University of Michigan. And I was lucky enough to have fellowships to live in Berlin then for 4 years while I researched and wrote my dissertation. And I discovered the Bauhaus Archive because I was working on Marianne Brandt. And, you know, I knew about the Bauhaus, but I probably knew what most people who'd, you know, done an undergraduate degree in art history knew, that it was kind of the boring modernism. And the more I was there and the more I was just seeing what other people were looking at and talking to the archivists and, you know, doodling around in the library, there was all this fascinating material that I certainly had never heard of. And the more I talked to other people, nobody had heard about it in the English-speaking world. And most of the people in the German-speaking world didn't know about it either. They had a pretty tame idea of what the Bauhaus was. And in fact, I don't know if it's in Holland or not, but Germany and Switzerland and a lot of Europe's kind of Home Depot is called Bauhaus. And that's actually where I accidentally went when I first tried to go to the Bauhaus archive. So you know, it has this association with the practical, you know, the getting things done right in everyday culture. And then it also just historically is seen as, you know, maybe a kind of popularization of the Russian avant-garde or a kind of artsy craftsy movement that was copying, you know, the British. And it's really, I think, largely misunderstood. So, you know, over time, I just went to more and more archives and just started in my own mind kind of creating an alternative history of the Bauhaus. And that's what this book then does.
Yeah, excellent. Okay. This isn't your dissertation, right? This grew out of work from that?
My dissertation now is so long ago.
So long ago,
2003, was on gender construction in photo montage in the interwar period. So there I looked at one Bauhaus artist, Marianne Brandt, and that, and the rest are, you know, it's like Otto Dix, Hannah Hoech, Alice Lex, who's a really interesting political artist who I think hasn't received her due. But one chapter of that, then I turned into my first book because I got another grant and spent a year in Germany really figuring out what Marianne Brandt's photomontages even were, that the shape and the number of pieces in that oeuvre were, that was not known. So that was that first book. And her work does crop up in this, in Haunted Bauhaus. But I'd say what was also formative for my thinking was working on the co-authored book that I did with Patrick Rosla called Bauhaus Women, which presents, it's written for a broader audience and it presents 45 Bauhaus women that we think everyone should know. And, you know, so I wrote half of those entries and we had a couple of guest authors in there as well. And, you know, so, and I was editing things I wasn't writing. So in my mind, then I also have like this all-female Bauhaus, you know, like what does the Bauhaus look like if we just take out all the men, not, you know, not out of meanness or payback, but just to say like, you know, what's a totally different way of telling this history that's been so male dominated, right? Because people tend to think of the Bauhaus as five dudes, you know, and in fact, there were 1,253 people there and 38% of them were women. So there's really a lot of history to be teased out there. And it looks quite different and much more interesting when you put the women back into the picture.
Yeah. Okay. Here I am. Yeah. Kind of always does look a little more interesting when we put the woman back in. And that's such an active process of removing women. And it's funny that we tend to think of that as that's almost the status quo, right? And it's easy to forget that the status quo was this decision. So when we make these decisions to tell the stories of women, kind of just, you know, writing this wrong.
If I can just say something brief about that, can I? Is that okay?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
It is striking to me how systematic it is by often, I think, well-meaning people. And part of it is, I think, particularly prevalent in art history because the field is so dominated by the art market. And what the art market wants is a genius. And women don't fit that mold very well. If they're too weird, they're seen as eccentric or crazy. And, you know, if we look at like Camille Claudel and Auguste Rodin, you know, they were both like fiery and weird and brilliant sculptors. And she was institutionalized, you know, and he was a hero. And so I just see them routinely, little gestures that make them smaller or just don't bring them up. And it's odd. It's frustrating, I think.
Yeah, absolutely frustrating. And I mean, there's the history of the Academy as well, like who's telling the stories and what you're interested in.
Right. And who's even allowed in the door, as you're saying, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Oh. All right. Okay, let's pivot over and let's talk about Haunted Bauhaus. So tell me what does this book do? What do you consider to be your greatest accomplishment with this work?
this book takes the notion of haunting seriously and, you know, sees the Bauhaus as an institution that's been so formative for modernism, but is so misunderstood, and really broadens out the history to retell a history of the Bauhaus that is much richer. So that, you know, is a broad statement, but I'd say that's really its accomplishment. And I drew a lot on Avery Gordon's book, Ghostly Matters, which I think does a great job of articulating haunting, which has been my sort of formative concept since way before I read that book. Like somehow I knew that was what this book was about. But Avery Gordon talks about how all histories and stories are kind of haunted by these figures that are, you know, almost like ghosts that we see in our peripheral vision, you know, that are sort of asking to be talked about and to be let out and to tell their stories. And so that's really what this book does through focusing on essential aspects of the Bauhaus that I think haven't received their due. So the first part is on the experimental religions and even occult movements that Bauhaus members were participating in, which were really influential, especially in the early Bauhaus. And I'm not the only one to say that about the early Bauhaus, but it hasn't been talked about much in English. And then I also then, you know, explain how these threads of it never go away. A lot of people see when the Bauhaus makes this turn from early on, when the slogan is, you know, to unite arts and craft together. The slogan then in 1922 becomes art and technology, a new unity. And a lot of people see that as, you know, okay, it's just completely objective and scientific, and there's no room for spirituality. And that's not true at all. There's a real thread of utopianism, an interest in what light can do. And a lot of the people who are making these high-tech objects like Laszlo Moholy-Nagy knew about and had participated to some extent in these experimental religions like Mazdaznan that were informative for the early Bauhaus, which was a kind of amalgamation, new religion that I can talk about more if you'd like. But even people like Jost Schmidt, who's seen as, you know, pretty hardcore graphic design guy, he was teaching students about the chakras and sort of how they worked in the body and how they influenced creativity all the way until the institution closed in 1933. So that's the first part. The second part, then the middle chapters are all on gender and sexuality. The first of those, chapter two, is on what I call shadow masculinity. So thinking about how Bauhäusler are trying to create, in a way, kind of a new man, as, you know, constructivism was, for example. and they're interested in, you know, rebuilding what an ideal of an artist in the wake of the First World War. At the same time, they always seem to shadow these figures with images of manhood that are somehow wounded or ineffectual or have inappropriate desires. They're always kind of undercutting this figure at the same time. And that balance, I think, is really important because Klaus Teveleit, in his influential book, Male Fantasies from the 70s, talks about how these kind of new man figures start to feed fascist manhood. So in a way, they're building a critique in. The third chapter is on new forms of femininity. Because I had this alternative archive of the Bauhaus in my mind, I didn't just want to be, you know, do another like, look, there's the new woman at the Bauhaus kind of a thing. I wanted to think about, you know, is there a project that I see women particularly working on? And to me, that's really about kind of modular design and transformation as a theme that comes up in their design and in their self-styling. So they're looking at kind of change, adaptable design, and how that applies to the fact that women's roles have really changed, right? They've got the vote, they've got new employment possibilities, and yet they're also still struggling then to be kind of women in man's world. And I conclude that chapter by looking at self-portraits by Marianne Brandt and by Gertrude Arndt, who is on the cover of the book. And she's, I think, a particularly fascinating case because she's a tale of a Bauhaus designer who is incredibly successful as a weaver. She's like their main rug weaver and considered a great colorist. But she'd really wanted to be an architect, and she was dissuaded from doing that at the Bauhaus, which happened to many women. And she eventually kind of just refused to practice her craft once she achieved a certain status of, you know, passed one of her tests. She just thought, you know, I'm not going to do this anymore. And when she returned to the institution, she was the wife of a master, her fellow former classmate, Alfred Arndt, and she just made these really strange self-portraits that are all about kind of refusing to perform, refusing to be productive and forward-thinking, which is what the Bauhaus is all about.
Hold on one sec before like we move on into the queer Bauhaus, which I'm so excited about. One of the things that I really loved in chapter one, was this idea of haunting, right? Of this kind of this liminal space that women take, that the spirits take. And so I see one of the points that I think you make really well in chapter one is that there is this very porous wall between spirituality and science, right? In this way that we don't necessarily think about, or it's a line we moderns draw much more clearly, right?
Yes. Yeah. And that is, you see that really clearly in the 19th century in journals like Sphinx that are, you know, about the science of the occult. This is considered a scientific field. And, you know, to all of us, like, it's so weird. We don't even like that just gets written out of history too, because it makes no sense to us.
Yeah. Know? We can't even make sense of that.
Yeah. So this gets kind of, you know, to go back and say like, well, what were the conversations they were having and what seemed possible to them, you know, and to take those seriously, like, you know, not, isn't it silly that they thought that, you know, you could read oracles in the clouds or whatever, but to realize like that, oh, that's just the tip of the iceberg. You know, Rorschach's actually come out of a tradition of believing that inkblots can manifest spirit presences that are all around us. And, you know, I mean, who hasn't gotten freaked out in their own basement or something, you know? I mean,
absolutely.
And to be in a world where imaging technology is slowly revealing all kinds of things that we thought we knew were there, like say, you know, the bones in your hand when it's x-rayed, or things that we think may be there, you know, some of which are true, like whatever, electrons or other things, yeah. Which, you know,
yeah, and it's not so big a jump, is it, to think that you can look at a picture of your hands and see the bones and then think that you can look at a picture of a room and see spirits.
Right, exactly. And when Röntgen did that x-ray of his wife's hand and showed it to her, she screamed and said, "I've seen my death," you know, and then this became the most reproduced image in magazines and journals worldwide around 1900. So, you know, there's a real fascination and hunger for, like, you know, they feel like they're on the edge and the visual world is unlocking this for them. So, you know, what the limits of that are perhaps clearer to us in hindsight, but, you know, we need to take them seriously for what those experiments were and what they meant to them at the time.
Yeah, well, you know, I had a colleague once who said to me that science is always wrong eventually. So, you know, he's right. Who knows what we believe is going to be ridiculous in the future, right?
Right. I know. Red wine is good for you, for example. That one's probably been debunked, much to many people's chagrin.
No, I believe that. I'm keeping that one. Yeah.
I'm glad that coffee's back on, you know.
That's great for us. I think it's interesting to take this, like, these fungible boundaries kind of idea and then think about laying out masculinity or ideal femininity, and that there's also, we see a lot of slippage there, right?
I am not I'm not sure I completely understood your point there. So can you just...
Okay. Yeah, let's start the question over. I just, I'm thinking about when reading chapter two, an ideal, like the ideals of masculinity that we're trying to get. And then through chapter three, femininity, that the Bauhäusler, Bauhäusler. German is not one of my languages.
That's all right.
Yeah, but so if we...
I'm consulting with Google, and so I've had to like spell this out for them because it's going to be a voiceover. So I wrote like Bauhäusler.
Excellent. That helps me too. Okay. So if we look at the ideals of masculinity and then the ideals of femininity, we can see that that's not as easily marked either 100 years ago.
Right. You mean that they're still really playing around with what it is to be a modern gendered person?
Mm-hmm, absolutely. And then that makes a nice link into queer Bauhaus.
Yeah. Yeah. And this has been, you know, such a lacuna in the literature, which doesn't make any sense to me, you know, given my biography where I got into art history because I was interested in gender studies, and this, you know, seemed like such a great place to do it. And so I think maybe, I don't know, 5 or 7 years ago, I gave a talk in Berlin, and someone said about queer Bauhaus, when I was just really starting to think about this and had identified Max Pfeiffer Vattenpool and was thinking more broadly about queerness and what I wanted to explore and how best to do that, and even just what the archive was. But, you know, so someone in the audience kindly said, who else is working on a queer Bauhaus? And I was like, nobody, but please come and join me. There's lots of work to do. So, right. I mean, I think the institution queer has so many meanings, right? And so in this chapter, I both wanted to kind of surface queer identities that were clearly central to a few Bauhäuslers' lives, but then also to kind of, you know, especially in the case of Margret Camilla Leiteritz, to the thinking about singleness studies has been really helpful, especially in that case, because I think there's been a tendency to go back and want to claim people whose partners we don't know about as queer, you know, to assign them a sexuality that they mm-hmm. haven't been given in the past. And this has been often cast and seemed also to me when I was reading it as kind of reparative to sort of, you know, allow them, you know, to speak for someone's history with the assumption that they could not speak openly in their own time. But, you know, singleness studies kind of points out that too can be a violence to, you know, assign mm-hmm. love and sexuality to someone when we just don't know. And Margret Camilla Leiteritz was an archivist. And so she curated exactly what she wanted to leave behind. It included some beautiful new clothes that she just bought, even though she was quite elderly and they still had the tags on them. I think she just maybe wanted some good options for the funeral. I don't know. But she, you know, destroyed her documents and letters and, you know, left a lot of extremely abstract paintings that actually represent scientific graphs. So, you know, it's sort of, and she left the graphs with them. So, you know, what they're showing. So she's very clear about what she'll let you see and what she won't. And yet some of her other works definitely are overflowing with images of female same-sex desire. That doesn't necessarily mean that she was involved with a woman. You know, she may have been, she may not have been. So to kind of give space for what the work gestures to without, you know, trying to write a biography of someone who, you know, clearly was saying no thank you to that. And yet to also then, on the third hand, to you know, say what we know about her and why she's an amazing artist who really, a lot of these people, once you find out what they did, they accomplished really important things for the school, for the history of design. So Leiteritz, for example, was one of a couple students who was very successful in the competition to imagine what Bauhaus wallpaper would look like. And wallpaper was important because it was a technology then that allowed for quick treatment of walls and apartments. Germany in the interwar period, as much of Europe, had a crisis of housing for workers, affordable housing, and was really needed. So, you know, to go in and paint, do multiple coats of paint in apartments was very time consuming, and wallpaper could give you something clean and nice looking, and yet, you know, it would be done quickly. So students were instructed to come up with designs, and I think there was a cash prize. And she, a third of the designs that went into production were hers. And there was another student, I think it was Hans Fischli, who had a couple more than she did. But then she also supervised the production with the Rasch company, and the wallpaper is what kept the Bauhaus afloat during the depression, the Great Depression, and all the way up till 1933. They had money to relocate to Berlin and restart as a private institution because of the wallpaper. So, you know, she was kind of at the helm of a major change in how apartments were outfitted. And Hannes Meyer bragged about the tens of thousands of apartments that had been outfitted with Bauhaus wallpaper in a few years.
Oh, wow. I had no idea about this. This is very interesting, and the idea of the importance of wallpaper.
I know. Right. I know. After we all spent years ripping it down, it was actually once really cool and
Well, and such a functional response, right? Such a functional way to go about making your home seem enjoyable.
Right. And just having it, you know, ready, like the idea of an apartment, of the perfect apartment for anyone to step into is, you know, we kind of rebel against something that's not personalized, but for them to have something like clean and functional and modern was, that meant a lot, you know, that was important to people. Should I say more about go back to the queer Bauhaus topic more?
Yeah, actually, I would love you to talk about a little bit more about that.
Yeah.
That's great.
So I tried to think about this as broadly as I could. And it's not that the Bauhaus was a gay-friendly institution. In fact, importantly, under paragraph 175, male homosexuality was still criminalized in the Weimar Republic, even though, you know, so many gains, including enfranchisement of women and kind of everybody, anyone who was adult, that was so important. And yet on this issue, the new government and the new constitution was just as regressive as Germany had always been. So there was a huge problem at the time with blackmail of men, even for the suspicion of homosexuality. So there was a problem of suicides because of this. And the reformer Magnus Hirschfeld, who created globally the first Institute for Sexual Science in Berlin, it existed for the same years as the Weimar Republic and also the Bauhaus itself. This was one of his main campaigns, is to organize and get rid of paragraph 175. They didn't succeed, but it certainly created a huge discussion about this that cut through all levels of society, because indeed, you know, this issue of the criminalization of homosexuality cut through all levels of society. So the first gay rights film came out in 1919, and Magnus Hirschfeld worked on the project, and he's actually interviewed, or he sort of does a therapy session with the main character in the middle of the film. The main character is played by Konrad Veit, which, you know, in retrospect is kind of hilarious because it's a silent film. So there are these long periods of them just sitting there talking to each other. And then every once in a while, an intertitle, you know, saying like, you know, love between men is natural. And, you know. But it's very earnest, and it's the first gay rights film in the world. And so Berlin really was very open. There were all of these journals for both queer men and queer women that circulated nationally and even internationally, that helped sort of create community across long distance. And there was an amazing club scene. So, you know, to think that all of this would be absent from the Bauhaus made no sense. And of course, once I started having a much broader knowledge of it, it was popping up everywhere. And so in the archives, there's one application that would have that I talk about in the chapter, by someone named Hans Volker. And Hans Volker had already studied at the predecessor institution, the Academy of Fine Arts in Weimar, had studied sculpture, had done some other things that normally at that stage of the Bauhaus would have meant he would have been admitted. They took a lot of students for the preliminary course who had a good background and, you know, sort of saw how they did. And the preliminary course kind of filtered some people out. And at the end of this application letter, Hans Volker says, you know, recently I obtained legal permission to dress in men's clothing, and I am making use of this. And signs the letter Hans Volker, formerly known as Johanna Volker. And so it's a case of someone who is trans. And this person wasn't ever in the school. So we don't know what happened, just that the application was declined. And there's no record of why. But it does seem quite likely that it was, you know, that this person was discriminated against. So, you know, there's things like that. There's the case of Anna Marie Hennings, who had a relationship with a woman and then left, where it just seems like certainly this was not particularly a supportive environment. But there are also people like Max Pfeiffer Vattenpool, who joined the school in 1919 and was gay. We don't know if people around him knew that at this point. But, you know, he definitely thrived there. Gropius thought he was an amazing artist, which he was. He worked in all different kinds of workshops. He had kind of a special permission to just kind of do what he wanted. And he's remembered for paintings that I don't particularly, I mean, they're fine, but they're kind of colorful Fauvist landscapes but he took great photographs. He learned from his friend Florence Henri, who also went to the Bauhaus. It's as far as we know where she learned to photograph. And they became good friends later in Essen and were all connected and hanging out in. So this circle of lifelong friends included Margarete Schall, who's Henry's partner, who was also at the Bauhaus, the weaver Greta Villers, who was also just his good friend. They took pictures of people like the dealer, art dealer Johanna I, kind seemingly almost in drag as a woman. You know, she looks kind of like divine is what she reminds me of the most. And, you know, you can just kind of gather the outlines of these other circles of Bauhaus members who were queer or queer allied and were spending time together and exchanging pictures and talking about, you know, Max Pfeiffer Vattenpool writes to Greta Villers and says, I made more pictures. They are, as one might say, very perverted. And you know, so there's a sense of play about gender and representation that has been totally missed from the Bauhaus. And that's really what this chapter looks into. And then also just, you know, images of same-sex desire that get played out, especially in photography. Max Pfeiffer Vattenpool takes several photographs of a young Italian man in an advanced state of undress that are, you know, so sexy. And then, and he's standing by a bed, which I always think it's like they say in a movie, if you see a gun, it's going to go off. Florence Henri, who I think is, you know, known for her iconic self-portraits, also for photographs of Marguerite Achal, who's not always identified as her partner, does, you know, really great images of kind of new woman, lesbian identity, a kind of, you know, independence in the way she's imaging these women. But she also does softcore when she is out of money because she's cut off from her inheritance through, you know, as I understand it, her inheritance was located in the U.S. and she was in occupied France, I think. So at any rate, she was independently wealthy, and for a period of time, she couldn't access her money. So she taught other photographers, including Gisèle Freund and other great female photographers. But she also then did commercial work that included nudes that were reproduced in mainstream journals, some of them, and some of them don't seem to have been reproduced anywhere. They really just seem more to have been images that she would have maybe just circulated among her friends, or perhaps sold. There's a whole great series of a woman wearing nothing but a belt. And, you know, they're just, you know, I think to integrate these into the oeuvre also of artists that we know are important.
I mean, there's, hold on, let me start over here. There, you know, when you're thinking about like queer and historically queer, basically any time up until just a few years ago, there are these rules for queer behavior, right? It's where everybody can read you as queer. You're definitely gay, but it's got to be within these limits that are deemed acceptable so other people don't have to deal with it.
Yeah, right. And there's also, you know, there's playing at being queer too, right? Which happens in so many institutions that are not necessarily at all open, like the military. So, you know, thinking about the role of that was another thing I was thinking about, because there's lots of, with all those fun Bauhaus parties, there's lots of men who are not known to have had relationships, you know, sexual relationships with other men, but they're, you know, they're doing that thing that happens in so many institutions where they dress up, one of them dresses up as a woman and they, you know, do a tango together or something like that, you know?
Yeah, it's performatively outre.
Right, exactly. That sort of carnivalesque, you know, let's play, you know, let's flirt with this idea within a context where it's boundaried and, you know, won't seep into our daily lives. Mm-hmm. But then, you know, these queer codes that we still recognize today are kind of exploding across Weimar culture in print media and lived life. So, you know, the Damen Club, the women's club Violetta was circulating flyers for, you know, all female events where, you know, maybe they all went to the beach together, or maybe in one of my favorite advertisements, they circled there's a cream puff eating contest, you know, like, you know, kind of silly, kind of sexy. And,
yeah, you know, wow.
yeah, it's really, really fun. And they're speaking, you know, they're gesturing towards the kind of things that we would recognize of, like, you know, celebratory, like, you know, liberation from shame, you know, just creating community and being who you are. And, you know, aspects of that are really at the heart of the Bauhaus very broadly. So I think to explore the queer manifestations of that was really important to restore to the institution.
Excellent. That is so interesting. God, this sounds like it must have been so much fun to do.
It was really fun. There were times where I was like, you know, it was fun to do a project that really felt so original. And it, I mean, I should say it took a lot of time and it took a lot of conversation, right? Like, you know, to present this to people and get feedback, and, you know, friends read stuff as I was going along and asked good questions. But it's, yeah, it does sometimes feel like, you know, to do something really new is very exciting, especially when it when it works. I mean, the book isn't out yet, so it feels right now like it all works. I'm sure some of the reviews will beg to differ, but that's okay. You know, that's sort of a mark of success. There's one Bauhaus member who I can definitely send. He's the one where I can send you a picture of his work. So depending on your time, if you'd like, I could say a bit about him, but whatever you think.
Let's see, where are we time-wise? I mean, it's a podcast, so we've got freedom. So tell me about this. Tell me about your guy.
So Richard Gruner is someone who I am very interested in. And there's not much left, although someone did just send me information about an archive that maybe has some work. So I'm hoping there'll be more that'll turn up. But Richard Gruner came to the Bauhaus during the early years, and there was one of the figures who was very important, and excuse me, and who has been written out of narratives of the school is a teacher called Gertrud Grunau, who next to Itten really helped shape the spiritual development of her students. So all students had to take a class with her called Harmonization Studies. In fact, Walter Gropius sat in on the class sometimes. Everyone was quite interested in this. And the idea in her class was that you would, there was a kind of objective sympathy between musical notes, places in the body, kind of feelings in the body, bodily movement, and color. And so if one was harmonized, one would sense, the body became sort of a perceiving instrument for sensing the resonance between, say, a particular color and a particular musical note or even a chord. And she was a composer and musician. This was a theory she kept come up with herself, and it was hugely influential in the early Bauhaus. And she, I think, was extremely well-meaning and very empathetic, but she also became a bit of a gatekeeper in terms of who was deemed ready to go on to the next step. And this wasn't a bad thing. This was the kind of thing the teachers were doing all the time. Itten would do it too. But she would just kind of look at people's spiritual development and say whether or not they needed to stay in the preliminary course or they were ready to choose a workshop. So interestingly, in her notes to the master's council, which is all of the officially permanent masters, she's sometimes considered a master, but she usually wasn't in those meetings. She gives these notes and she says of Richard Gruner that basically, like, there's something he's still discovering about himself that seems to be holding him back. And, you know, we have no idea exactly what she meant, but it sure sounds like someone who's in the process of coming out and struggling. So I just sort of put that out there about him. We don't know, but that's a possibility. And he did another semester of the preliminary course and still wasn't deemed ready to go on. So he left, which is true of many Bauhaus members. I mean, lots of people are only there for a semester, but it's so formative that we definitely consider them part of the movement. So he went on to become a graphic designer. He was a leftist activist, very involved in socialism. And he did this wonderful cover of a book called The Red Children's Republic, which was a camp of workers' children that was self-governed for a week. And they also took pictures. And then he and another graphic designer helped them to put together this book. And he designed Gruner designed the cover. And it's just this great abstract red square that is made into a flag and a photograph of a youth, kind of looking all happy and sunny into the future. And Gruner's great graphic design work is mostly what we have because his archive didn't. So already quite early on, once the Nazis came to power, Richard Gruner was arrested. He was very active as an anti-fascist and was working on an anti-fascist journal, but he was arrested for being gay. He was accused and denounced by a neighbor for having had, I believe the quote was something like, a very loud gay party. And he spent the rest of the Nazi period in concentration camps of different degrees of horror. His work was destroyed. He did survive. There was a death march at the end, and he managed to just leave that. I think things were pretty chaotic. And he was never rehabilitated or compensated by the regime afterwards. Victims who were in of concentration camps, those who survived, were compensated financially, but those who'd been put in concentration camps because of paragraph 175, the anti-gay statute of German law, were never compensated. And no one, you know, he was just ignored. No one did an oral history with him, and he kind of died in, in poverty and without that much help. He did have friends who helped him survive, but he continued to be discriminated against under a paragraph 175, which stayed on the books in Germany until the 1990s. So he had this really tragic life. At the same time, it was his art that seems to have given him some solace, because already in 1945, he made a whole cycle of lithographs that, you know, kind of represent what he experienced in the camps, just the various horrors of the camps that were, it was kind of a way of, I think, trying to let the ghosts out and to show people what it was like to suffer. And those have been shown, and because they're reproducible in multiples, a set is held in the U.S. Holocaust Museum and in various places in Europe as well. So he's, I think, a case of, you know, the wrongs of the time and how the period itself, the institution, but also the period itself couldn't make space for queer voices, except in certain guises like graphic design, you know, a bunch of happy kids, that kind of stuff is all okay. Leftist political activism is okay. But if it's coupled with, you know, a fighting for or an interest in living, you know, just living a free queer life, that is not okay. And that, you know, it didn't kill him, but it ruined his life. And I think those stories need to be told too.
Yeah, absolutely. That is a really tragic story. That's so sad.
It's so sad. It's, yeah. And I wish, you know, like I'm of an age where I think he died in the 80s. You know, I would have been a teenager, so I wouldn't have known what to say to some old guy. I also couldn't speak German at that point. Fair. But, you know, I feel like I just missed, you know, actually going and having a conversation with these people and saying, you know, tell me your story. Tell me what you did. Tell, you know, any works you gave to anyone, you know, that might be hanging on someone's wall that I can look at, you know, that kind of thing. So,
yeah. I know exactly what you were talking about, this realization. I mean, my interest, I'm a 17th century historian, so my people are good and dead, is, you know, fair. That's how I like them, actually. If I'm going to talk about who they had sex with, it's best that way. This, by the way, is not. This
like
isn't.
Our colleagues who work on cave people, I just feel so bad for them. You know? Someone was telling me about being really excited about finding a depression in the earth. It was quickly, like someone had dug a pit, and I was like, "You're so screwed."
Wow. Yeah, that's that. I've got Inquisition cases at least, yeah. But I recognize very much this when I developed my kind of obsession with Paris in the 20s. My realization that those. I was still alive. I was alive and a functional human when they were still there.
Yeah.
Like I just missed Sylvia Beach. Like she died when I was of an age to have understood who she was.
Right. Right. I hadn't thought about that, but I lived in Paris that's where I picked up the Dutch boyfriend in 92 to 93. And I went to Shakespeare and Company and people said, you know, yeah, it's this kind of weird place. It's really interesting, but it's kind of weird. And there was some like weird woman running it or something. And now like I teach cubism and then I do a whole, unit on Women of the Left Bank and make the case constantly of like, you know, it's fine. Like we can root history in cubism, but we could also tell a completely different story and root our history of the 20s completely in this circle of women, you know, many of whom were involved with each other. And, you know, it's just as rich and just as exciting. And the work is amazing and goes in so many great directions that you wouldn't expect, that are much more modern than you would expect, you know, like, God, if there's another exhibition of Picasso's weeping women, I'm going to hang myself, you know, like he was a dick. Like he was a good painter, but he was like, he made all the women around him cry. Do we have to like monumentalize that again?
No, right. And enough. And he might've starved to death if not for Gertrude Stein. So right. Why don't we ever talk about that? Yeah. Okay. Sorry. That was total tangent, but
it's, I mean, I sort of latched onto it because it's, I think doing that teaching has been a model for how I think about the Bauhaus of like, what if we like, I mean, of course, you know, we can't ever go back to the zero hour, but like, what if we just tell a history that's not reactive, but is just constantly pushing, like, there's another story here. There's what's the other story. And it's so much better that way.
It's just, it's a fuller picture. It's a more interesting picture. And it actually reflects what was happening, you know, this very rich world, as opposed to the tiny little strands we decide to tell a bit.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, Form Follows Function is interesting, but after a while, it gets a little old.
Fair. All right. Okay. So in let's wrap this up. So tell me about chapter 5, Red Bauhaus, Brown Bauhaus.
Right. So the political, the way that I learned the Bauhaus, and I think it's often been talked about, although hopefully that's changing some, but often the political within the Bauhaus is seen as kind of a misstep or, you know, sort of poison seeping in from the outside. And I cast it as much more kind of, you know, reflective of how the Bauhaus was, as the Germans so beautifully say, a child of its time. But also that, you know, for example, the communism within the Bauhaus, which was central to its later years, was really the fruition of that utopianism that I talk about in chapter one. So, you know, it's much less kind of ethereal and spiritual, but it's just as much a hope for a better world, for sort of uncovering the good within the world all around us. And so in 1927, a communist cell is formed within the Bauhaus, and a lot of students joined. Membership actually cost, and students didn't have money, so you could often be an activist in something without being an official party member. And it was really central for thinking about, you know, under the director Hannes, the second director Hannes Meyer, starting in 1928, this idea of, you know, creating goods for the masses rather than creating luxury goods, which was a slogan he promoted, and for thinking about really practicality over aesthetics. Of course, there's still a strong aesthetic in everything they're designing, but, you know, communication should be clear. For example, apartments should work well. And, you know, design should be affordable rather than just simply appearing to look modern. And a lot of what interests me in that, too, is then thinking about things like, you know, photography. What are some of the pictures that then come out of this mindset? So I look at the photographer Etel Mittag-Forda and her images of, for example, there's a photograph of Lothar Rothschild and Alfred Menzel who married. And so there's a photograph of Lothar Rothschild and Albert Menzel, who were both communist activists. He was actually secretly the editor of the in-house handmade communist zine, is what I would call it. It's very homemade. And she was also a communist activist who went on to write for a communist paper in Frankfurt. And Ethel Mittag-Forda takes this photograph of them where they're it's just really this gorgeous image of, you know, two stylish young people who are, you know, they're looking in the same direction. She's leaning on him in this very dynamic way, and he's clearly just intent on telling her about something he's really excited about. And it's just such a great image of a kind of emerging form of equality, I think, based in their politics. And all of them are communist activists, including the photographer. So, but I also look at photographs we have of Bauhäusler participating in street demonstrations, creating, you know, agitational propaganda carts to say, like, you know, using Bauhaus graphic design to say, workers, you know, you're supposed to be cannon fodder for the next war. You rebel with us against this. There's going to be a demonstration. So to really look at how their design was important to activism, to changing daily life, but also really working in an overtly political manner. And some of what I bring into that chapter, for example, I draw on oral histories that Michael Siebenbrot did still in the GDR. He talked to Bauhaus members, and they wouldn't give their names because in the GDR, you know, everything was so politicized that people were afraid to do that. But they talked about how, you know, even though political activism was shut down in the Bauhaus once Hannes Meyer was kicked out in 1930 and Mies van der Rohe became the third director, and this was an attempt to save the school because it was seen by right-wingers in the city of Dessau as dangerous and Bolshevist. So political activism was suppressed, but they do things like, they reported that list four was for the voting for the communists. So, you know, that would be a slogan at the time, vote for list four. And the whole Prelahaus wing, which was the student block of student work live-in studios. They just turned off all the lights in the building at night and then turned on the lights to make a giant four to kind of, you know, beam out to the city like, this is what we are, pro-communist. And yet they could still say like, what? No, it was just chance who like was asleep and who had their lights on. So they did stuff like that that was, you know, not preserved anywhere, but but was important kind of time-based activism. What also I thought was important to tell, and this is actually what I'm going to be working on in the future, is there's another thing I think generally about art history, which is that we so often want our artists to be heroes and our art movements to be on the right side of history. And that's just not how it was. So there were conservatives and right-wingers and even Nazis who were in the Bauhaus. There weren't that many. It was a smaller group, but students who came in the early 30s reported the canteen, for example, being kind of divided on party lines, that, you know, there were certainly enough conservative students, right-wing students, that they actually constituted a part of the lunchroom. And this has very important implications for them, the Bauhaus afterwards, because the story then that usually gets told is the Nazis shut down the Bauhaus in 1933, more or less true. It was actually shut down by the masters themselves as a final choice to not conform to Nazi demands for, you know, kicking out all foreigners and things like that. But the Bauhaus shuts down, and the story usually is told then that then everyone goes away. They spread the Bauhaus word around the world, and especially people like to talk about the Bauhäusler who went to the U.S. and started Black Mountain College, the new Bauhaus in Chicago, and taught at places like Harvard and Yale. So those things are all true, but the vast majority of Bauhaus members didn't leave. They often couldn't leave, or they chose not to. And there are people like Fritz Ertel, who was an architecture student in the later Bauhaus, who was a Nazi party member. He joined the SS. He was very convinced of his Nazi ideals, and he worked as an architect at Auschwitz. And that is where quite a number of his colleagues, eight, if I'm remembering correctly, perished, including Lotte Rothschild, that woman I mentioned who was in the photograph by Eto Metaxfora. So, and people like Friedel Dicker, who, you know, in the meantime had taught Bauhaus methods to 500 children at Theresienstadt ghetto and concentration camp. So I think to tell the institution story also in relation to a politics we all can recognize in retrospect as abhorrent is important as well, because, you know, aesthetics has no inherent politics, and it, those ideas, those designs and methods could be used for evil as well as for good.
Hold on, no, my turn to cough here. All right. Okay, so your new work then, you're going to be interested in, are you looking at the theoretical idea of like that art has no politics, or you're looking more at right-wing Bauhaus, or tell me where you're going next?
Yeah, I'm really interested in kind of telling the story of the Bauhaus, of the what happens when people stay in Nazi Germany and satellite countries. And I think it's going to be sort of through case studies. The last chapter of the book lays out some case studies. I may, you know, I'll certainly continue to pursue some of those threads. But basically, I'm interested in how the building itself was used, the massive Bauhaus building in Dessau. It was pretty quickly turned into a home ec school. And I just was in the archives looking at it. There's a real relish in the local press in the language around how they talk about how this has become, you know, a school for, you know, there are photographs of women with dolls learning to put on diapers and, you know, really kind of traditional ideas about femininity and women all over the institution. So there's a kind of gendered rebuff, I think, inherent in that. It was such a large building that they could do a lot of things with it. So it was also a Gau school for Nazi officers, I think, or kind of lower level officers. So it was being used directly for Nazi propaganda. And for a while, it also was an institute for rocket research. And, you know, these are a bunch of scientists looking for space, but all the language is about, you know, kind of the future of Germany needing to be in high tech, as in high tech for war. So I'm interested in, you know, it must be said that although right-wingers particularly abhorred the Bauhaus and the new building movement more generally, their use of a flat roof, right? And they would talk about it in very racist terms. They would say, this is not from here. This is Middle Eastern. This is Jewish. But it does need to be said that the Bauhaus's roof did leak. And, you know, there is a good solution for that, which is long known in Germany. And the propagandists loved it when they were able to put a slanted, you know, a regular roof on the Bauhaus. And I have yet to find a picture of what it looked like, but there's a lot of reporting of basically like, slanted roof comes to the Bauhaus. You know, like, finally, we've gotten rid of this degenerate foreign roof. And funny how the propaganda sees like just, you know, really stupid things that they cotton onto. So the building is one part of it. I'm trying to, so, and the reason I'll have to do case studies is a lot of history was destroyed. A lot of people afterwards retold their history in a light that made them not look bad, because they need to, you know, move on. So to think that I could do a comprehensive history of the Bauhaus under Nazism, I think is inaccurate, but I'm planning to keep digging and look at, you know, how people survived if they were trying to resist or just get by, also if they were Jewish, how they, people like Herbert Bayer, you know, created propaganda even though they saw themselves as apolitical, or just participated in a kind of passive propaganda machine. I'm interested in Ilse Fehling, who works for Tobis Film, which is the main you know, Nazi film company making these, you know, costumes for fluffy historical, historical films, you know, kind of screwball comedies, although I think even at the time, Nazi screwball comedies didn't work really very well. So, you know, I don't want to look back and assign blame, but more to acknowledge that the Bauhaus continues in various forms, some of which are resistant, many of which are compliant, some of which are actually actively supporting the Nazi regime. And I want to investigate that more.
All right. Yeah, I that's sad. That's sad. I want Bauhaus to be awesome, but of course, it's the story of an institution. All right. So,
I'll keep thinking about it. I do sometimes think, like, is this too much of a downer of a topic? Are people going to want to read this book? You know, I haven't gone that far into it, so maybe it'll be a little book. But I just feel like it's important to, yeah, not even to say, like, you know how you think the Bauhaus is good? Well, it's not all good. But this is a real problem, right? Like, you know, we have this fantasy that people should, you know, should just, if they find it immoral, they should go and be a part of something else. And it just wasn't always practical, say, or possible sometimes. You know, there was a point when people couldn't leave. So,
no, of course. And I don't think, you know, I don't think when you're in the midst of something, you necessarily understand what's happening around you.
Exactly.
You know, yeah. I think this is definitely a time where we're seeing that.
Right. And I do think, like, when would I know when the point is where to look back on this situation, I'm culpable just for being here, you know, like, because initially with people like Herbert Bayer, I thought, like, he stayed until 1938, like, you know, and he made those kinds of pictures. What a jerk. And then later I thought, I learned more, you know, he was Austrian. He saw himself as apolitical. He was married to a Jewish woman and he was taking the work he could get, you know, which doesn't excuse what he did, but it certainly, you know, I don't think my role is to judge. I think my role is to sort of tell it like it was and also contextualize it. And yeah.
Yeah. That's our job as historians, right? It's not my job is not to try to demonstrate the moral worth of the past. It's to just tell the story.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right.
We'll maybe after that, I'll do something really light.
Yeah, like some, like, you know, unicorn history or something really enjoy.
Right. The history of the rainbow.
Yeah, you're gonna need a new century if that's your goal.
Yeah, right. It is a little dark. Yeah, and I mean, I should say, you know, one thing I'm also constantly working on the side is just really telling the story of Bauhaus women and their work. I'm working on something on Ringel and Pitt. Greta Stern was in the Bauhaus, and they were Walter Peter Hans's first two students, and they were just hilarious. And they had this kind of fake advertising studio. I mean, it was partially real, but it was the Depression, so no one really needed that much advertising. And it was just this really fun, cool collaboration. So I'm interested in that. And then there's also this woman, Hilde Hubach, who I wrote a short essay on for Bauhaus Women. But in the process, I knew, so she was a photographer. She was a hellion. She, got involved with her teacher, Karl Hubach, the painter, and her parents put a private detective on them and found them in a hotel room. So then they had to get married. And they were, I think, really interesting. He took these, he made amazing paintings of her, you know, with a hairdryer and a Marcel Breuer chair, like just as this weird kind of quirky modern woman. And then she seems to kind of drift away from him and goes to the Bauhaus and becomes a photographer. She does worker photography. You know, she's Jewish. So eventually she's first in Vienna, then in the UK, and lands in New York. And there, you know, I knew MoMA had some photographs of that she had done, but they went into the documentation end of MoMA, so there wasn't, not much was known about them. And I read that she'd been a society photographer. So I started Googling, and she took photographs. She was listed somewhere as the family photographer of William Shawn, who was the editor of The New Yorker. And I found one of his sons, who's a professor at Bennington College. And I was like, do you know anything about this? And he thought that was hilarious that someone had said they had a family photographer, because he was like, it wasn't really like that. But he remembered the name. He said, I remember that name being spoken of with reverence. And his brother is Wally Shawn, the actor. And so he was sort of talking with Wally while he's older. And he was like, oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. And oh, but also when I first wrote to him, he said, well, I'm looking at a photograph of my father on my desk right now that's by Hilda Hubach. Wow. And yeah, so periodically he sends me more family photographs and tells me, you know, what the, about the context. And William Shawn was, he lived a double life, right? So he was a really interesting editor for a long time of The New Yorker. When I said his name, my mom right away said, oh, of course. But I'm not the one to uncover this. There have been biographies and memoirs written. He had two families. And so, and he was painfully shy. So I'm very interested in, you know, this man who had this double life and this woman who was a hellion and a leftist who comes to New York and remakes herself as a family and children's photographer and advertises in The New Yorker. And, you know, just what those, how those lives seem to intersect. She was known as kind of the only one who could get a good photograph of him because he was so painfully shy. So there are much more happy stories that I just yesterday, Alan happened to send me some photographs, and I was just thinking, like, I've got to write something about this and like go look at those photographs at MoMA and see what I can sort out about her, because she had no children. And, you know, she's probably like, her work is still probably on dozens of pianos somewhere in the greater tri-state area. But, you know, no one knows how special she is and how amazing her life is. And so I'd like to tell that story too.
I would love to read that story. I hope you tell that.
Okay, good, good. Oh. Well, that'll be the happy channel next to the unhappy channel.
I will also look forward to hearing about the dark side of the Bauhaus. So keep writing. This has been a wonderful interview. It's been great to talk to you. Thank you so much, Libby.
Great to talk to you too, Jana.